people often think that in the liturgical calendar, the great challenge for Unitarian Universalists are the real holidays and holy days, Christmas, Easter. As a Unitarian Universalist, what are you going to say? Because there's no normative theology. That's child's play next to Mother's Day. Mother's Day really presents the challenges, because if you make it to hearts and flowers and violins, I think I just did this backwards, the Paul McCartney violin. Is this the right way?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. If you do it to hearts and flowers, there's the danger of insulin shock for the congregation. And then if you do it too cynical or intellectual, it's completely unsatisfying. So Unitarian Universalist clergy wrestle with this more than either wrestling with him about Easter. So let me wrestle about Mother's Day. Fortunately, Anne set the tone, because the truth is, it wasn't invented by Hallmark or by the floral industry. It actually has really good political and social roots to it. And so we can really celebrate Mother's Day without embarrassment. Ambivalence, perhaps, but not embarrassment. When I think of Mother's Day, I think of songs. Some of them really hideously inappropriate, but I will share them anyway. Once upon a time, when I was working at the Troubadour, there was this young act called the Smothers Brothers. And this was before they were kind of full-blown comedians. They actually were folk act, and they could sing. And eventually, I just prayed for them to finish a song instead of going into the silliness, because they really were very musically talented. And I remember them singing, M is for the many things she gave me. O is because she's only growing old. T is for the tenderness she taught me. H is for her heart as pure as gold. Put them all together, they spell moth. A word that means the world to me. This was the beginning of their transition. And I remember that moment well, because they had suckered me in completely. And that's one of the real issues about mother and motherhood, is that we carry it in two different hands and in very different chambers of our hearts. Part is to make icons out of mothers. Well, when you become a mother, you'll understand everything immediately, and your heart is going to open, your life is going to change, and you are going to become the platonic form of motherness, and you won't get tired, and you won't resent changing diapers at 3 o'clock in the morning, because your heart will have been touched and opened. And then these mothers get very disappointed when, in fact, 3 o'clock in the morning is the same drag with a dirty diaper and baby that you imagined it to be, and the transition is not instantaneous. The love, perhaps. But there's still that other part. You don't automatically become a plaster saint and the platonic form of all motherness. We also look at the other side, and mothers get attacked. Probably not starting, but in the 1940s, a writer, Philip Wiley, wrote a book called A Generation of Vipers that was a complete takedown of mother and motherhood. In the 60s in Berkeley, there was a great denigration of mothers. Turns out that denigration was of mothers who became mothers automatically, as opposed to by informed consent and choice. Many of the ideologues in Berkeley thought, well, just becoming a mother automatically because you're 22 and your clock is ticking, 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 is not a great motive. But to choose to give so much of your life and so much of your heart and so much of your vulnerability is, it turns out, a very important and honorable choice. So there's a great tension. The religious view of motherhood is, or of mothers, is pretty ambivalent. When you look at how women are treated in Scripture, number one, most of Hebrew Scripture is against romantic love, which I know is very counterintuitive, but romantic love almost always leads to tragedy because you are out of line. You need to be, the older daughter needs to get married first and the younger daughter second, or everything is out of line and you're in big trouble. David gets into lots of trouble because his heart and other body parts wander and stray. And biblical characters throughout get into trouble when they don't follow the orders, but they follow their heart. So romantic love is a problem. In the Christian scriptures, just sex and birth are a problem because a woman is supposed to be a vessel of purity, and somehow that vessel gets dirtied by sex, I guess, and maybe even by birth. And so Mary not only needs to be a pure vessel and a virgin, but she needs to be without original sin herself. What happens so often in religious tradition is that religion takes women and seems to make icons out of them, but icons in most traditions, and Dennis may correct me on this, are not living things. Icons are static, and their holiness is static, and the women get made into icons, get put onto pedestals, and then the pedestals get put into the homes, and the doors and the gates are locked. And they are honored by isolation and by coming and by becoming, in a sense, the means of production. We'd like to think that our modern times and science and therapy has enlightened us, but then we get Mr. Freud and Freud's theory about Oedipus and Tom Lear's explanation of Oedipus. You all remember that. There once was a fellow named Oedipus Rex. You may have heard about his quaint complex. His name appears in Freud's index because he loved his mother. He loved his mother like no other. His sons were his brothers and he sure knew who a boy's best friend was. When he found out what he'd done, he plucked out his eyes, one by one, a tragic end to a loyal son who loved his mother. So be nice to your mother. Now and then send a card. But you better see that it stops at that, or you might end up like old Oedipus. I'd rather marry a duck-billed platypus than end up like old Oedipus Rex. We have an ambivalent relationship with the entire concept of motherhood. And add to that, as Unitarian Universalists in the 60s and 70s, with the zero population growth movement and greenness all around, the idea of, well, you'd be really irresponsible if you reproduced. And that has an effect on how people see mothers and motherhood. Now, the idea that Unitarian Universalists were trying to get below replacement rate in terms of birth wasn't the best strategy for the religious education program, as it turns out, because there again is this relationship between motherhood and children and children in the RE program. And some of our congregations that had, one particular congregation at one time had 250 kids and a Olympic-sized sandbox, shrunk during the late 70s and early 80s down to about 40 kids in the religious education program. So we were intellectually successful and physically successful, and no one's come up with a strategy more inimical to growth since the Shakers. So we're trying to revisit that and treasuring each birth in this congregation. Which brings me to sex. Can we all handle this? I'm scanning to see if there's anyone young here, young enough that this would embarrass. There's a wonderful line in a book that says that life is water's way of tricking nature into taking it around the universe. Sex is nature's way of tricking us to evolve, to exchange genetic information. The first amoeba is still alive, and it hasn't changed very much. It's multiplied, but it hasn't advanced. We, on the other hand, have changed from, unless there are those here who don't believe in evolution, we have changed from the primordial slime into something, for the most part, a great deal less slimy and capable of building and thinking and questioning and celebrating and weeping and being fully human so far. We may be able to become more fully human over a course of time, but we've done pretty well from that early exchange of genetic information. I found out this week, as many of you I'm sure found out, and this is kind of the iffy part of the sermon, if the Oedipus Rex part wasn't, that we may have some Neanderthal genes in the room. As far as I'm concerned, anybody who buys genes for more than $35 is thinking like a Neanderthal, but that's not what it means. For years, the scientists and geneticists were telling us that we had no relationship with the Neanderthals of Europe and, as it turns out, the Middle East. Now, I read a headline that said, "Humans mated with Neanderthals." Parse the language. That's no information. You want to do a list of what humans have mated with? That doesn't give you information at all. Now, the issue is humans bred with Neanderthals. That's the big story, and they're finding some proportion of European and Asian Neanderthal genes. This, I predict, and this is a heads up, incidentally, on what's going to become a racist story. I'm actually very serious here for a moment. Europeans and Asians carry Neanderthal genes. Africans don't. So watch what's going to happen from the race in the racist world. In the racist world, you can probably tune in on KFI tomorrow at 9 o'clock and find out. I'm noticing which one of you are laughing, so I know that you know who that is. On 6:40 at 9 o'clock, it's Rush, yeah. They're going to point out the Neanderthals are going to be rehabilitated. They're going to become the geniuses, and it's going to be their genes that make Europeans and Asians superior. This, of course, is silly. We are all carrying the entire history of humanity, but it is going to be a story. If sex is nature's way of passing on genes and developing human beings, we understand that it's our job as parents to pass on our genetic information, to be part of that future. But it's not simply a biological and physical act. Being a parent, creating a legacy, is not a question of sperm, egg, and genetic information alone. It is a question of time. It is a question of values. It is a question of what we do to model and demonstrate who we are to our children, our grandchildren, and all of the children in our community. That's where we get our legacy. I know it's always tempting to say, well, I'm having children so that I don't die. I want to achieve immortality through my children. Woody Allen was asked if he was trying to achieve immortality through his films. And he said, no, I want to achieve immortality by not dying. That's the most effective way. The second most effective way is in conveying the genetic information of our values through our actions, demonstrating who we are, what is holy in our lives? What informs our hearts? What animates our hands? Expands our generosity? The Unitarian theologian at Harvard wrote that everybody has an animating principle, whether they call it God or not. James Luther Adams was his name. Give me a week with them and I will tell you what is holy to them. I will know by what animates them, what makes the veins on their necks stand out in rage or in passion. What is the thing that is at the center of their life? What I suggest to you on Mother's Day is that what can be at the center of our lives, whether biological parents or non-biological parents, when we bond with children, when we bond with the future, is this conveyance of what is holy to us. The evolution in which we all play a part for our entire lives, from the time that we are young and can first function as role models to our younger siblings or their friends, to the time when we are old and even grandchildren have scattered into the larger world, we still are a presence in creating the future. Every interaction we have with every person, with every child, is a model of who we are and an example, for good or ill, to everyone else. We stay in the game of making tomorrow for our entire lives. Now, in terms of mother, and I need to talk about my own mother, because if not, then I'd have to pay retail to a therapist, so I'm going to do that with you. My mother was hugely influential, not simply in terms of bringing me into the world and not taking me out, although she did give a talk at my previous church once, that said, you know, Jonathan was just a perfect infant. Never gave me a moment of pain or of anxiety. And then he was born. And everything changed. Well, clearly she gave me her sense of humor, her love of politics, her love of people. She carefully rehearsed me in public speaking. She was the single greatest influence on public speaking, making me write and memorize the impromptu subjects for speech tournaments and debates. I had a rocky road with her from time to time. There were 10 very tough years, because one of the things that everyone in family and in every marriage ceremony I've ever done, what we romanticize without understanding that love, like faith, is not constant. It goes up and down. It's a roller coaster. We can get angry. We can get alienated. We can yell and scream and slam doors and still be connected, still understand the blessings amongst the curses and the thorns among the roses. I had 10 tough years with my mother. Never doubted for a moment that she loved me. When I was coming back with my wife from Peace Corps in North Africa, we were coming back on the QE2, and I obviously had not seen my mother for 2 years, and I had written faithfully once a year. My brother, who was in India, by the way, wrote every week. So if he missed a letter, she was hysterical in calling the embassy in Delhi, because something must be wrong. About me, she didn't worry, because she knew I wrote faithfully every year. So as we're sailing past the Statue of Liberty, and I'm feeling patriotic and teary, truly, I turned to my wife and I said, my mother is going to be on the dock. She said, come on, she lives in Los Angeles and she's too old to do this kind of traveling. I said, my mother will be at the dock. As we sailed in, I could see her waving. That is faith. That is the knowledge that you know that through good times and bad times, there are abiding connections called love. They are not erased by troubles. They're not erased by alienation. They're not erased because our mothers were not perfect as parents, and they're not erased because we are not perfect as children. As much as I would love to believe in my very good learning curve, I'm not even perfect as a grandparent. I'm better. There is some learning and lots of hugging, but I'm not perfect. And the faith at the core of life and of parenting is that we have connections with each other, whether we're biological parents or adoptive parents. I see no difference in how love is manifest. I see no difference in that bonding, which I did not really understand until I became a parent, and then it was reinforced when I became a grandparent. I had no idea that instantly the presentation of this young, newborn, vulnerable life into my arms would go bypass my arms and go directly into my heart. That's the connection. It won't make me perfect. It won't make my children or grandchildren perfect. But there is a bond that we create when we give our hearts during the joys and sorrows. Talked about just how difficult it can be sometimes to love. And love is difficult. It is challenging because when we open up our hearts, we take off the armor that protects them. And we become vulnerable. Our hearts can be touched. Our hearts can be pierced. Our hearts can be broken. And to do otherwise is to cheat ourselves out of the greatest experiences of life. So on Mother's Day, we rehearse, we remember the times of love. We remember the tears, we remember the shouting, we remember the help, we remember all those useful things that our mothers said to us that Jennifer left out. Run like that and you'll put your eye out. If you eat standing up, you'll get fat ankles. If you make a face like that, your face is going to freeze. My parents didn't have to be right, but they were just so cute. And I carry both my parents lovingly in a peaceful chamber in my heart. And may you carry your parents, your children, your grandchildren in your hearts. Understanding your vulnerability, welcoming your vulnerability, because that vulnerability is truly what connects us to life.